Welcome to Truth News Radio Australia on this 30th of June 2010. Very welcome to join us for the next hour or so as we go through the stories that are affecting our world at the moment. And we also have a very unusual interview coming up. Our mystery guest that I announced last week is scheduled to return, and we're going to be discussing some rather unusual scientific matters, which I'm actually not even going to express an opinion of until I've had a chance to engage with it. I'm presently somewhat doubtful of the validity of this, but Josh Jackson, who'll be coming on the show in about 15 minutes, is quite keen on this interview, and he thinks that the man concerned has some interesting information to share with us, so I will hold back on judgment until I've had a chance to engage with it. Now, before then, we've got quite a number of stories to cover, and we're going to begin with stories that are directly relevant to Australia. Julia Gillard stands by her partner over Israel job link. Julia Gillard says she arrived at her views about Israel well before her partner, Tim Matheson, took a job with the Israel lobbyist, Albert Dayton. Her partner had his own career, and he's got a right to live his life, the Prime Minister said. Mr. Dayton, the chairman of the property developer group Ubitas and the founder of the Australia-Israel Leadership Forum, said last night the decision to offer Mr. Matheson a property sales consultant job was made entirely by myself with a specific aim of filling a vacancy for the role. Mr. Dayton released a statement saying that Mr. Matheson had undergone a successful trial and has demonstrated his capacity and Ubitas plans to continue his association with him. Ms. Gillard has disclosed to the Register of Interests held by members of Parliament that Mr. Matheson had begun work with Ubitas in November 2009. Anyway, we'll leave you to explore that story. Basically, we don't know the depth of the connections here in terms of how this affected Julia Gillard's positioning for the job of PM, but from what we've seen around the world, the Israel lobby groups have such power and such influence that her husband being allied with a prominent Israel lobbyist, and combine that with the fact that she has she's been a staunch supporter of Israel and refused to even criticize Israel over the Gaza incursion and kept completely mute over the Israel passport scandal, which her predecessor in her role as PM, Kevin Rudd, had actually pursued with some level of legal rigour. These facts all kind of fit together to lead one to conclude that, yes, there is a strong connection here between Julia Gillard and the Israel lobby, and that is something we should be very concerned about. Prime Minister Julia Gillard said she wants Australia to have a carbon tax and is prepared to fight for it. Yes, indeed. The new PM is determined to put a price on carbon. Ms. Gillard told the Nine Network several days ago that she had no doubts about the emissions trading scheme, that she had doubts about the emissions trading scheme because there was no lasting and deep community consensus for it. I was concerned that if you were going to do something as big to your economy as put a price on carbon, with the economic transfer that implies, you need a lasting and deep community consensus to do it, she said. I don't believe we had that deep and lasting community consensus. But Ms. Gillard says she will work to get a price on carbon. Interesting here in the news stories, Julia Gillard is always referred to as Ms. Gillard, even though she is married. I'm not quite sure what the reason there is, maybe because she's not using her husband's name. Anyway, I just merely reflect on that as an interesting curiosity. Anyway, just going on with the story here, which is from the ABC, she says, "I believe in climate change. I believe it is caused by human activity, and I believe we have an obligation to act." Well, you know, this is of great concern to many, many of us. This is actually the elite position on how we manage world affairs. We just ignore people's opinions. We ignore democracy. We ignore anything other than our decisions that we've made. We then present it to you as if it were based on something that you can trust, like science. But when the science actually disagrees with what we have chosen, we just say that all those scientists are wrong. And when more and more people start to pressure the government, we create a phony dispute within the government. We get rid of one leader, we elect another. And despite the fact that there was overwhelming evidence towards the end of 2009 that people did not want this emissions trading scheme, we, the elite who control the media, paint a picture for you that the masses of people were actually angry with the former leader because he backed down on his emissions trading policy. And we are now desperate for the new leader to actually bring in some kind of policy. And the type of policy she's going to bring is actually going to be more like a straight tax than an emissions trading scheme. Although that seems to be, you know, there's some grey areas there which haven't been filled out. But the point I'm making here is that this is the massaging of public opinion, or this is the massaging of people's belief in what public opinion is, which is an even deeper level of societal programming than I think most of us realise is going on. The media wants to create the impression in your mind of what most people think, which will in turn, because of our inbuilt tribal mentality, we will then fall into line because we all want to fall into line with what most people think. Okay, moving right along. The next few stories we're going to talk about relate to the G20 conference in Toronto. And quite a lot of information has come through over the last few days. Some of it obviously from the mainstream, which has shown pictures of burning police cars, people smashing windows. A group known as the Black Bloc has been, was, I think on Saturday, rampaging through some of the streets of Toronto. And this group has actually been associated with other violence in Canada. And in response to that, the police cracked down with quite a strong level of violence against completely peaceful protesters. And we've got video here of people, completely non-violent protesters, being shot with rubber bullets and beaten, and all kinds of quite sinister and vicious tactics, predatory tactics almost, being used by the police. And the reason why this is an important news story for Truth News, even though it's way on the other side of the world, you could say, well, what does it matter? Well, Canada is, we like to think, is one of the more enlightened countries in the world, very similar to our own Commonwealth country, legacy of concepts of democracy and social inclusion and freedom of speech. And when you confront the material that's now coming from Canada, to see a country that has basically fallen so far from those ideals in the way the police behave, it's a really important warning sign for what we have coming up in Australia if we allow the erosion of our rights and continue to allow the police to be given the kind of godlike status to impose their will upon us. So I want to go through a few of these stories, and I think the one that I find most interesting at this point is this. Well, actually, there's a few. Toronto G20 police admit that no 5-meter rule existed on the security fence law. Now, the police in Toronto had been going around telling people that there was a 5-meter rule excluding people from even getting close to the security fence, which surrounds the actual G20 conference. Now, there was a giant fence that they'd built, and the overall cost of all of the security measures that they took for this conference was apparently $1 billion. That's what I've been told. It seems incredible. Maybe that's for the entire conference in itself. I don't know. It's a massive amount of money. Staggers. It's boggling to the mind. But in addition to this giant fence, which is very similar to what was constructed in Sydney during the APEC conference in 2007, in addition to the fence, the police were going around telling people that there was a 5-meter exclusion zone around the fence, and that if you strayed too close to the fence, you could be searched, and if you didn't produce identity, you could be arrested. Now, a lot of people were arrested under those terms, and it turned out that the rule was a completely bogus one made up by the police. There was no power to search people coming within 5 metres of the fence, said ministry spokeswoman Laura Blondal. The area designated by the regulation as a public work does not extend outside the boundary of the fence. Asked Tuesday if there actually was a 5-metre rule given by the ministry's clarification, Toronto Police Chief Bill Blair smiled and said, "No, but I was just trying to keep the criminals out." Okay, moving right along, just want to welcome to the show Josh Jackson, who joins us from his studio.
G'day, Josh. Harold, how are you? And g'day, world.
Yeah, look, Josh, we're just in mid-story here. I've been covering the some of the stories from the Toronto G20. And there's some really interesting material coming out here as we've seen these stories unfold of riots and people smashing windows and burning police cars. And then we've seen the police turning on the crowd. We've seen people being beaten. We've seen people being snatched from the crowd who are basically just standing there completely harmless. We've even got a video of actually completely peaceful people being shot with rubber bullets.
Yeah, now the thing is, right, that whole burning police car thing seems extremely suspect to me. First of all, I'd just like to say that, you've got a whole every bit of force behind the state. You've got stormtroopers there fully padded up with the most hardcore, with gas masks and triple shield, eye protection and tasers and machine, just really kitted up, thousands of them. Then you all of a sudden have a few people with balaclavas manage to burn a police car, and they let it burn for almost 2 hours while the media could get really nice images of it all.
Yeah, look, and on that particular topic, I'm going to play you a short video here, which illustrates the fact that these violent anarchists, the Black Bloc as they're called, were actually allowed to go on this rampage without actually being stopped by the police for quite a long period of time. So I'm just going to play you a short clip here, which was put together just from someone on the scene. So I'll just play this for you right now.
My name is Joe. I'm a photojournalist. Yesterday I was following the protest against the G20 summit, and I started to follow the Black Bloc. As the end of the protest reached Queen and Spadina at around 3, Somewhere between 75 and 100 Black Bloc members rallied. They left the main protest and started quickly back down Queen Street, heading east. On the way, they encountered two police cars with police in them, which they attacked, broke windows. There were riot police at the intersection of each street that went south from Queen Street into the financial district, but they didn't engage the protesters. They just watched them go by, smashing windows and spray painting. From there, they turned south on Bay Street and started into the financial district. There were three police cars abandoned in the intersection at King and Bay. The Black Bloc started smashing the police cars and set one of them on fire. After around 15 minutes, they walked north on Yonge Street, smashing windows along the way. There were no police to be seen anywhere. The streets were full of people going, just kind of doing normal things. At 4:20, they reached College, where they smashed more windows on their way back to Queen's Park. They also smashed some windows at a police station. When they arrived back at Queen's Park, they had all huddled in a circle to remove their black clothing. And then after that, I just lost track of them. They kind of just blended into the crowd or disappeared from that area altogether. There are lots of other peaceful protesters in that area, since it is the designated protesting area. After about a half an hour, the riot squad started to move into the protest zone, and another group of riot police came from behind Queen's Park and surrounded the protesters. They squeezed the protesters and bystanders as they pushed us back, hitting us with batons. They hit me in the back and my field producer in the hand, breaking his finger.
They broke my finger as I was trying to walk away.
Go on your knees.
And they were also pepper spraying the protesters at that time. We knew we were going to try and follow the Black Bloc, so we were.
We'll just pause it there. Now, you're welcome to watch the rest of these videos that we've posted here on the Twitter feed. Josh, how do you analyze this? Some people had been saying that it was actually the police who were posing as the Black Bloc. That may be the case, but I think it's always a little bit more complicated than just a simple black and white thing. These anarchist-type people do exist, and they can be used. And this is actually what really happens in the real world. You have a combination of police infiltration and control of violent groups.
Yeah, well,
combined
with
the fact that there are such groups.
I'm calling them anarchists because they, you know.
Well, yes, it's a term.
They're obviously not. They're obviously just thug hoodlums that want to, you know, cause problems and have no real respect for anybody.
Well, actually, we will have to probably investigate who the Black Bloc is. I do think they are a group that does call themselves anarchist. So right. We may need to, you know, actually prove that if that's what we're saying.
No, but in terms of, you know, philosophy, you know, I mean, it's just kind of a joke, you know.
Well, yeah, I mean,
you see up at Porkfest, which is a big, massive anarchist fest up at up in Canada. It happened this weekend.
Yeah.
Thousands of anarchists. No one, people leaving their stuff everywhere. No one stole anything the whole weekend.
Yeah.
People leaving their doors open in their cars. Absolutely peaceful. You know, nothing happened. All of a sudden you get, you know, this other meaning. Anyway, a whole other subject. Now, how do I analyze it, you say? Well, I tend to think, let's have a look at the media, the media coverage behind all this. We see hours and hours of, everywhere you look, any media that covers the G20 protests are covering these burning police cars and these riots. Now, you've got the whole violence of the state, you've got millions of people in prisons, you've got these two major wars of aggression happening where there is so much violence that the state is creating over in Afghanistan and Iraq, with people dying every day. Then there's, you know, a couple of police cars go up and there's some screaming yobbos, and the whole focus is on that. You sort of tend to think, where's the true journalism here saying, hey, the leaders at these G20, most of them, I think out of the 20 nations, maybe 7 or 8, even more, are involved in the Iraq and Afghan wars. And look at the violence going on there.
Absolutely. And, you know, a point that was made in a really good article I read, I can't remember which one it was, but they were pointing out that the G20 is supposed to be a public meeting. Just kind of like, you know, in theory, this is no different to like a sporting event or, you know, an international symposium of music, or, you know, it's just a meeting of leaders to discuss important things, right? It's a public event, right? Funded by us because it's governmental, which means the taxpayers actually own it, right?
Yeah, and you know, they spent over $1 point something billion, I heard.
Well, this is what I heard too, and I mentioned that earlier. And the point is, but what they are doing with these events, and that, you know, every year there's ones, and what they're doing is they're turning it into a kind of like a power demonstration. Of like, we own the world, you are our slaves. And, why can't they have it on an
island somewhere?
Yeah, and you are not even allowed anywhere, and we will take over a city, and we will put a giant wall around it, and the residents of that city, will be excluded. Yeah. And in the actual Toronto one, which I was covering earlier before you came on, the police invented a law that didn't even exist. They said that there was a 5-meter exclusion zone outside the fence, right? Now, this is how totally stupid this is, right? First of all, they build a giant fence, right?
Yeah.
Then they say, well, actually, even if you come close to the fence, we can arrest you. And they were snatching people. They were demanding IDs and strip-searching people for walking close to the fence.
Yeah, total violation of personal freedoms. And when we had the Youth Week here maybe a year, 2 years ago, where the Pope came out, and all of a sudden they passed new laws here as well, saying that you weren't allowed to be offensive or wear offensive T-shirts. And that law quickly got overturned because all these civil libertarians got involved. But you see this sort of things that happen over these big events. They sort of just pass these big laws, these ridiculously invasive on any sort of personal freedom laws. And but what I really, you know, think about when these big situations happen is, sincerely, why aren't they putting them in an island somewhere and saving the taxpayer, you know, $1 billion in security? I mean,
I think they want to do it in big cities.
I don't know, a big ship or something. Just
I think they actually intentionally do it in big cities as a demonstration that we are total slaves
in control. That's right.
Yeah, it's a power demonstration.
Yeah.
Why else would they do it? And why do they go overboard with the police presence? And, you know, it's all again to show us that we are scum, that they own the earth. And then they allow some riotous group of people who obviously have no real platform. I mean, as I was saying, this Black Bloc, well, if they exist, let's find out who they are. Do they have a spokesperson? You know,
well, look,
probably not.
I wouldn't put it past. I mean, it was in Toronto about 4 years ago where agent provocateurs actually got busted.
Yeah, they determined that they were actually police because of the boots. Now, the boots they were wearing were identified as actually having a yellow dot on the bottom, and it was quite damning. I think what they do is it's not that all of them.
Well, the police had to come out and admit they were, and they were holding rocks, and then to get out of it. See, just to break it down for the folks at home, what happens is the police dress up as rioters.
Well, I think just to be clear, I don't think all of the rioters are police. I think a few of them are police occasionally.
Oh, yeah, of course.
And a lot of them are actually genuinely rioting, okay? Because I've actually seen quite a lot of footage here from Russia Today, and some of the people there were talking, and they were actually, you know, people who were kind of on the side of the rioters.
It's like a soccer. It's like a soccer match in England. You get these yobbos that just use it as an excuse.
Yeah.
To be violent.
That's
and
right.
And they've got no platform. They've got nothing to say. They just want to run amok.
That's right. That's right.
And, you know, there is definitely those people. Then on top of that, you have police that dress as agent provocateur. And they go in there, and to get out of the situation, they start attacking the police. So the police grab them, pull them behind the police line, and get them out of problems. Now, this time in, I think it was Toronto, four or five years ago, they actually were holding rocks. And it was a total peaceful demonstration, and some of the union leaders ousted them and cornered them. And that's when they freaked out, started throwing rocks at the police. The police grabbed them and pulled them out of the line. Then there was this big media stir about it, saying, hey, they were actually the police. Turns out the police commissioner had to admit it what they were. And of course they said, oh, we were just going around trying to figure, you know, it was intelligence gathering. Well, why do you need a big rock in your hand and a bandana? Everyone else had their full face showing, and these police had bandanas across their face, looked totally nasty, bricks and stuff in their hand. And so, you know, don't put it past them. Now, to say that these cops' cars burning or the black block crew police is unknown and unjustified, and I don't think they probably are. They're probably just idiots. But, you know, you definitely don't want to just rule that out.
No, it's so true. It's so true. Look, we're going to have to break at this point. We've got an interview coming up, which, Josh, you're going to be leading this one. I haven't really studied up on it.
Yeah, it's an amazing guy who's a physicist. I'll let you in after the break.
Okay, cheers. Okay, well, it seems our mystery guest is still a mystery, and we're trying to bring that to you. In the meantime, we will move on with some other stories. Now, we covered earlier the news of Julia Gillard and her Israel connections and her views on a new carbon tax. Now, just the whole situation, I think, with the transition of power in Australia that's just taken place, I think is worth a little bit of reflection. Would you not say, Mr. Jackson? What my theory that I proposed, it was really just an off-the-cuff hypothesis, right, that I proposed earlier, is that we saw an elitist's power shuffle that was done for a particular reason. And it does seem to me to be very closely connected to the carbon issue, the carbon trading, the price on carbon, as they're now calling it. And what we saw, the end of last year, we saw actually a movement, a real democratic expression from the average people, as manifested by, you know, callers on the Alan Jones show, you know, huge response to Lord Monckton when he came out here. People don't like the carbon tax, the carbon trading scheme, call it what you will, people are aware, they're waking up to the fact that they've been hoodwinked over the whole carbon issue. Now, the Liberal Party jumped on that, right? And the Liberal Party did a power shuffle. They took, what was his name? Gone blank. The guy prior to Abbott?
Abbott.
The one prior to Abbott? Sorry, I've just gone blank.
Prior to Abbott was... Jeez, yeah, I've gone blank.
Embarrassing.
Too.
Okay. In that guy, okay.
See, that's how fast you just disappear out of.
Yeah.
If you know.
Anyway, they replaced one leader with another leader in the Liberal Party. They replaced a climate change believer with an on the fence, you know, sort of not out of the closet, but one suspects a climate change skeptic, Tony Abbott. Mm. Then Copenhagen was a train wreck, right? Then Kevin Rudd comes back from Copenhagen, doesn't mention the emissions trading scheme again. It's like he just went into the memory hole, you know, stops talking about it. Then the media does this amazing thing where they start to spin this idea that the public is actually doesn't like Kevin Rudd anymore because he didn't come through on his plans for the carbon emissions trading scheme.
Yeah.
And in fact, you know, the public...
Nobody goes behind the scenes and says, right, who were the power brokers that orchestrated this bloodless coup? Who were the people that forced him out? Who were the unions? Who were the bigwigs? Who were the big bankers? Who are they? Who are the people that actually orchestrated this? Because it wasn't that the Australian people wanted Kevin Rudd out. We hardly even knew. We turned on the TV at 6 o'clock. All of a sudden, we've got a different prime minister.
Exactly. I mean, that happened so quickly. There was, you know, a slipping in the polls. But, I mean, all leaders go through that. And to be honest with you, Kevin Rudd was looking a bit ridiculous, right, in that, first of all, he'd said climate change is the greatest moral challenge of our generation. And then he goes to Copenhagen, comes back and doesn't mention it again. But the point is, the reason why he didn't mention it again and the reason why there was that change of leadership from the Liberal Party, Malcolm Turnbull, sorry, my memory's just come back, Malcolm Turnbull had been the previous leader of the opposition. The reason why Malcolm Turnbull was kicked out and Tony Abbott put in was because there was a big movement of people in this country questioning climate change, questioning the truth of CO2 and anthropogenic climate change, and definitely questioning the ETS as a solution to that, even if they did believe in it. And, of yep. course, the Labor Party was aware of this same phenomenon, so the Labor Party changed its policy as well. It wasn't Kevin Rudd on his own. In fact, it was Julia Gillard who put the pressure on him, and she's admitted that. She has actually admitted, Julia Gillard has admitted, that it was her idea to pull back on the ETS. It wasn't his idea at all.
The other thing I want to know is who put forth the concept of the mining tax?
That suddenly just came like a bolt out of the blue, didn't it? Just like in the last couple of months.
And who told Kevin Rudd to do that? I mean, that to me just looks like a nail in a big coffin. You don't come out prior to an election announcing one of the biggest tax hikes in Australian history to a sector that's so powerful. You just know you're going to get a lot of enemies.
Indeed, that is so true. What we're seeing here, I believe, is a way of manipulating public opinion. And as I said earlier, what they're doing is it's more sophisticated. In some ways, it's more scientific than what used to happen. They now try to persuade you that other people think something to make you think it also. So they want you to believe that most people are angry at Kevin Rudd because he didn't bring in the ETS.
Therefore
you are going to be your subconscious desire to be part of the tribe is going to make you have that opinion too.
Yeah, all of a sudden you wake up and you think, yeah, he didn't go through with the ETS. That's why we kicked him out. That's why we kicked him out. We had nothing to do with it.
We had absolutely nothing to do with it.
You know, and the other thing, the other big con behind the system running in Australia, primarily the Westminster system, is all of a sudden we wake up with a different prime minister. Now, people say, oh, yeah, but you don't vote for the prime minister in this system. You don't vote for the prime minister. You vote for a party. Yeah? Well, why do they call it Kevin 07? Why is it the whole cult of personality based around Kevin Rudd during election time? Because they know it's about the person.
Yeah.
They know it's about the face. Let's meet Kevin Rudd's wife and children. What are they all about? You know, it's this sort of personality thing. So people, of course, people vote for the person. And then overnight, it just shows what a scam our democracy is.
The primitive psychology is what they're appealing to. That's what, you know, it's been, terms have been used before. It's a scientific dictatorship that we seem to be living under, that they're trying to manipulate psychology all the time.
Yeah, two-party scientific dictatorship.
And, you know, it's become more and more sophisticated over the last few decades. It began with television, really, this increased forms of manipulation. You know, the earlier generations, the earlier epochs, obviously, you know, had their own ways of doing things. But we look at what's going on now, and it's much more polished. We tend to look back at history, and we tend to think, oh, you know, what they did back then was so terrible, and we're so much more advanced now. Well, you know, history will tell. But the things that are going on now. There is such crises happening in the world due to this overbearing militaristic empire building of the globalists.
You know, Mussolini was the one to say, "We had to be the first in Europe to take away individual freedoms because our system is so advanced. Our society is so advanced from everyone else's."
Absolutely.
Like it's some amazing thing to take away people's liberties and freedoms.
Now, on that note, I just want to move on to another story.
Why, thank you, guitarist.
It's a pleasure. I'm sure he enjoyed it. The next thing I want to talk about is a story that I just picked up today because I happen to be listening to American program NPR, All Things Considered. And The title is Non-Judicial Foreclosures, the latest step in America's descent into Dickensian injustice and moral squalor. Actually, that was the title I put on it.
Title.
Yeah, I did that myself.
You really brought it home.
Now, what they're actually doing now, and they're doing it in Texas, is people who have missed a couple of payments on their mortgage repayments are actually being foreclosed. And I'm just trying to find the article because I have a lot of trouble sometimes getting my articles up quickly enough. And believe it or not, here it is. Here it is, opening it in a new window. I really need to have about 10 screens to do this show because I've actually got two screens, but it's really nowhere near enough. I don't have enough screen real estate to have everything.
No, like we need 500 screens. Folks, in fact, if anybody wants to donate an old monitor, Truth News Radio Australia is where you can send it.
Yeah, I'd put it like, maybe I'll put it above me and kind of lie back.
Yeah, yeah, and anyway, some sort of, Batman style.
Yeah. Here's a story about one particular person who was serving in Iraq in the army and doing, you know, very dangerous work. He's a war hero, you might say. He was halfway through his deployment when he got a bolt from the blue, a frantic phone call from his wife back in Texas. She was bawling on the phone and telling me that the HOA, the Homeowners Association, had foreclosed on her house and it was sold, he says. And I couldn't believe that could even happen. He had a hard time understanding what his wife was saying. His $300,000 house was already completely paid for. Could it be possible that their home was foreclosed on and sold because his wife had missed two payments on their homeowners association dues? Now, America has this organization called the Homeowners Association. And I don't have all the details on what it is, but it appears to be, and it sounds like an innocuous, community of people who help each other, right? But they have dues that you have to pay. Now, in this particular story, his house was already paid for, but because he owed some dues to this organization, his house was sold on the courthouse steps.
Sounds like a mafia protection money thing.
Absolutely. Almost. And apparently this is happening quite a lot. There's some kind of weird loopholes in the law that allows it to happen. And sometimes it'll be over a debt of a few hundred dollars, right? But then as soon as you're late paying it, if you're 27 days late paying it, they increase that to $3,000, right, with lawyers' fees and stuff. Then if you don't pay it within another month, they'll foreclose on you. And so over a debt of a couple of hundred dollars, people are losing their homes. And this again, you see, this is part of this incredibly wicked
fascistic.
Yeah, it's all part of this fascist, corporatist, globalist system that's grinding people down. And it just breaks your heart when you hear these stories, doesn't it? I mean,
Imagine you've got children. All of a sudden, you're out on the road.
Yeah, and it's not as if you've defaulted. I mean, people do default, okay. And when you sign up to an agreement, we can all accept that if you default under the terms of what a loan is, that you accept that you would forfeit your property. But there's supposed to be all kinds of checks and balances on the way there, not just a loophole that allows them to completely destroy you and violate your rights, or just take away any concept of sovereignty or ownership. And again, I just want to compare that to that story we had in Toronto with police snatching people who just walked too close to the fence.
Yeah,
you know what I mean? Like we can, as odious as it is, we can say, well, you've put your fence up, right, and you're not going to let us in, but we can walk up to that fence, right? No, they won't even let you do that. You see, It's diabolical, the mindset behind what they're doing. And all I can see it as is this, again, these are all power plays. These are all demonstrations that there is an owner class and there is a slave class.
Well, yeah. There's a productive class. I've said it, yeah, and productive class and a class of predatory, just suction beasts that just basically take, and then rule. And, I don't like the whole classist thing that much, but it really is showing to be more and more the case when you have huge, over-the-top amount of military hardware and you can't do anything. I mean, they just go around saying, no, this is how it is.
So true.
We're going to just install 1,000 cops in the city and And if you even walk up to your business, say your business is behind the fence, you know, boom.
Yeah.
We're going to arrest you.
You're done. Now, another story I want to cover quickly. The Obama internet kill switch has apparently been approved. It's actually not gone through to be passed into law, but it's been approved to go on to the floor of the Senate. Now, Josh, what do you think about this Obama internet kill switch? I'll just read you the story.
I love the idea.
Yeah. I'll just read you the story from the Sydney Morning Herald, because we did talk about it briefly last week, but there's been some developments. The U.S. senators...
Being sarcastic, folks.
The U.S. senators pushing a controversial new bill that some fear would give President Barack Obama the powers to seize control and even shut down the internet have rejected claims it would give Obama a net kill switch. The bill, titled Protecting Cyberspace as a National Asset Act, has been unanimously approved by the U.S. Homeland Security Committee and whoever the heck they are, U.S. Homeland Security Committee. I didn't know they were part of the government anyway. And they will be put to a vote on the Senate floor shortly. Lobby groups and academics quickly rounded on the bill, which seeks to grant the president broad emergency powers over the internet in times of national emergency.
It's similar to just having, sorry to interject there, you know, the president to say, well, during a hurricane, we are allowed to just come and shut down everything to do with you and force you underground.
Absolutely. That is basically, exactly... Yeah. And, you know, I mean, disabling the internet is kind of like the only way you can do it is kind of by an act of vandalism, really. You know, you really just have to sort of switch off DNS servers and basically break it. You know what I mean? You can't really switch it off because it is a distributed network. And the way the internet was designed to work was actually to make it immune to that kind of, It was part of the idea was actually due to the Cold War fears that there could be a nuclear strike. So they didn't want to have centralized systems of storing information. So that's how the internet works. The network can always rediscover itself from any node. So even if like all the computers in the world were destroyed and there was one computer, that one computer could still maintain the internet. Then you get another computer and it's there again. You know what I mean?
As long as it's a DNS router.
It's a protocol more than anything else. Yeah, it's just a protocol of sharing information. It's not really a thing. It's a medium. So you know, how do you break that medium? Well, it's kind of, you've got to jam it. You know, it's like what the military does when they want to stop people communicating. They jam it. You know, well, with the internet, you've got to do things like turning off routers and just making it really difficult for that communication
to
occur.
I can pretty much guarantee, apart from the hard wiring of undersea cables, that if they tried to shut down the internet, it would soon be up and running somewhere else.
Yeah, that's right.
Rerouting
exactly.
Around America. Yeah, you wouldn't have your Gmail. You wouldn't have your Google because, well, actually, you probably would. You'd have the European servers just taking it up, pulling up Slack. So...
I mean, when you in your home, if you set two computers up and plug them into a local area network, that is the internet right there. That's the internet has become the main communications protocol. So, in other words, let's say the whole world gets destroyed, right? And there's just you and me. Well, we could have our internet together.
Well, exactly. I mean, about 10 years ago, I set up a little mini internet because. You know, we were young students. We couldn't afford the bandwidth. So we wanted to do file sharing just from PC to PC. So there was this thing in Sydney where you could basically take a Pringles packet because it's got the nice, beautiful little silver lining on the inside.
Right.
You stick an antenna and then there was an internet page where you could have a look. You could type in your longitude and latitude.
Yeah.
And it'll tell you where to point it with a compass.
Really?
And it points to the next house. And then the next house points to the next house, and this was all the way from inner west all the way to Bondi,
really,
and
that's
up
amazing.
To the northern suburbs. Had this extra internet, which wasn't, you know, all you needed is one node to go out into the actual internet, and all those houses were connected for free, And we were sharing files with one another. We were doing all sorts of fun. It was great. And because, you know, we were just dissing Telstra because Telstra was sort of the only option back then. And it was like, no, well, if, you know, and we were sharing our music and all sorts of stuff across that network.
That is extraordinary. You're using Pringles boxes.
Pringles boxes, yeah. They're these perfect little tubular antennas.
Yeah, well, see, ingenuity, like human ingenuity will always spring up. And this leads me into another quick rant I want to give about the dozens of movies that have come out in the last few years about the world going into a state of complete chaos if some terrible catastrophe occurred. And there is a belief, and it's coming through these Hollywood movies, that we would descend into some sort of primitive state. It goes back to the Mad Max movies, in fact, from the 80s, you know, that we descend into some kind of primitive state where we just become absolute monsters. You know what I mean?
I
think that is complete bunk. I really do.
Ridiculous.
Yeah, it's good for Hollywood. It's great for telling a story, right? But it's not the way the world works. The world has never worked that way. The recent one I just want to talk about briefly is a film called The Road. I don't know if you've seen it, Josh. It's been at the cinemas. It's a end of the world scenario where some terrible thing has occurred. We don't know what it is, and they don't tell you in the movie. All you know is that all of the trees are dead, and it's very cold, and it's very bleak, and the skies are all grey, right? And most of the people have died, but there's still a lot of people walking around. But there's no sort of civilization left. But what they depict in this movie is that people turn into cannibals. And that there are these kind of like these tribes of people who are eating other people, right? And the story is about a father and a son trying to sort of get from one place to another and not be eaten by the cannibals. But it's actually very well made, and it's actually quite, you know, starkly, you know, powerful in the way it's portrayed. But when it got to the cannibal scenes, I thought, hang on, I'm being fed a bit of ideology here. I'm being fed a line about, you know, without government, people just turn into cannibals. You know what I mean? Like you take away the infrastructure and people just descend into some sort of demonic level of behavior, which I really don't think
would happen. You know, we're all so evil. Yeah. We're all so bad and destructive and awful.
But because
we've got these beautiful governments that look after us all, we're angels.
And, you know, I think in times of extreme hardship, what actually happens is people learn to care for each other more. I think that if there was some terrible food shortage, I don't think we'd become cannibals. I believe it in my heart that is not what we would become. You know what I mean?
It would become quite desperate. Like you said, people tend to help each other.
Yeah, exactly. Okay.
So
shall we just see where the status is with our mystery guest here? Have we had any more details come through?
Yeah, we'll see. I'll try to give him a buzz again.
Okay, we'll take a short break.
We're gonna reap what we have sown. generation's blank stare. We better wake her up this time.
Sick of the lies, deception, spin and half-truths? Well, so are we. You're listening to Truth News Radio Australia. Tune in every week at truthnews.com.au or subscribe to the podcast with iTunes or your favourite podcatcher.
Okay, we're back. Well, we seem to have a problem there with our mystery guest who is maintaining his mystery and two strikes. Well, okay. Well, we'll just have to see how we go with that mystery guest. I'm not sure when we'll be able to reschedule it, but we may. Josh, would you like to just give us a recap of what the guest was going to be talking about today, just so that we don't drive our listeners mad with this sort of suspense?
Well, Dr. David Lewis Anderson, he is a physicist. His interests are in space-time physics and special relativity, and he's basically worked for over 20 years on time manipulation technology and they've managed to be able to send DNA back and forward in time right now. And there's some amazing stuff. There's a whole institute called the Anderson Institute, and we were going to have him on the show to discuss some of the findings that they're finding now with and you know, really grill him about Excellent. What it means to manipulate time.
Well, there you go. Never say we didn't tell you what it was about. Now, just before I forget, the song we were listening to before was Jackson Browne, For America, and it comes to me from a Facebook page that I actually started, which is called Songs of Freedom. So if you're on Facebook, if you have a Facebook account, it's a completely open group. You can add to it, So I invite you, I cordially invite you to add your songs to this Facebook group, and we will play them on the show, because we're always looking for great stuff to play. You know, I have this penchant for Bob Dylan, as you know, and, you know, but I need to kind of listen to other stuff too, right? So we really do like all great music, and we love songs of freedom. You know, we love songs that express the human spirit, don't we, Josh?
We do. And talking of freedom, I just want to talk about what that word means, because I think it's been taken from us.
Go for it. Let rip.
I think it's been manipulated. And you know, the original notion of freedom is freedom to be creative, freedom to have your own person, freedom from being coerced and having some other person telling you what to do, the freedom to express yourself. And I think a lot of, especially sort of the communist movement, the socialist movement, they sort of taken that term to say, no, freedom actually means the freedom from ever feeling any suffering.
It's interesting you should mention that, you know, because this was also in George Orwell's 1984. In his book, there is a language called Ingsoc, which is to replace the English language. And they actually want to remove words which actually give people any concept that they actually have rights or freedom. But I seem to remember in the book, the word freedom is used, but it's redefined so that the word freedom only can mean freedom from something, not freedom to something. So it's not freedom to do what you want. It's freedom from hunger, you know.
Yeah. That's right.
Such things.
Freedom from hunger.
Yeah.
Freedom from,
the dog may be free of lice, you know. Yeah,
freedom from poverty.
The dog may be free of lice, but the dog is not free, right?
Exactly.
The dog is a dog.
And, I mean, there's other terms as well. Like in America, the term liberal has been totally manipulated to meaning something totally other than what it is. I mean, traditional liberal comes from liberty.
Yeah.
And
libertas.
And it's funny, a lot of people that are into, personal freedoms and stuff will say, oh, I hate those liberals.
Yeah.
And I just think that's really quite absurd. I mean, it's sort of pre-1900, the original term is, it means that thing. And it was sort of taken by the left to sort of the extreme left and...
Now, Josh, you've been taking a look at the writings of the great economic historian Hayek.
Yes.
I've also been doing some browsing in that area. And what I discovered in...
The Road to Serfdom.
In The Road to Serfdom, which is a really excellent book. I didn't go to university and study these things. I did a degree at uni, but I never got into economics. And, you know, it's probably something that a lot of people have studied in their first year at uni and think, big deal. Well... Quite often you'll find that these source material primary books are actually even more relevant a couple of generations down the track.
It's amazing. I mean, this was written in 1945, 44.
Yeah. But there is a point that's being made in his book about freedom. And I think, just if I can summarize it, is that he said that freedom has got to be the founding principle. It's the one that you don't sacrifice. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like freedom has to be the one thing that you preserve even when... It may make certain things more inefficient. It may actually sometimes be quicker to achieve a goal by having a very authoritarian approach. But if you sacrifice freedom for that, it's not worth it. And just let me give you an example of that. If we were to say bring in sort of Saudi Arabian type laws that you have your hand cut off for stealing anything, right? Mm. I bet you crime would drop. I mean, it would. It would work as a deterrent. But would it be worth it, you see? Would the sacrifice of the basic dignity and rights and freedom of the individual be worth the drop in crime rate you'd have from bringing in such a draconian measure? And most of us would agree, no, it's just not worth it. That's why they abolished the death penalty here in Australia. And in many countries, they abolished the death penalty because, again, yes, possibly it does act as a deterrent, you know, and there's a lot of debate. You know, some people say, well, it doesn't even work. But even if it did, you'd say, no, we don't go there. We don't go there because we don't sacrifice our basic principles.
Yeah. And the you know, the other point to that is if we, you know, if we look at the common ground of every, you know, what's good for the collective, and we say, well, what's good for the collective might not be good for some people. So, but to make everyone not poor, we're going to have to do this, this, and this, and intrude in a lot of freedoms on individuals. And then you think, well, is it fair that you actually put people in prison? A better example is the war on drugs, you know?
Sure.
So they're saying, oh, well, for society, for the whole, let's put anyone that touches any drugs into jail. And you think, well, what about and then people in it with a collective attitude say, yes, that's good for everyone. But it's this sort of, it's this double think, because it's not good for everyone, because if you take it then down, it's actually not good for the people that are caught with a bit of weed in their pocket, something that grows naturally and normally, and decide to, you know, affect them, their own selves.
Merely for their own purposes, their own use, yeah.
Yeah, and then get put in prison where they can, where they usually get tortured or beaten up or raped, you know. And you think, well, how's this good for everyone?
Yeah, the greater good. We were talking about that a couple of shows ago. It's actually a ridiculous point of view as soon as you analyze it. I don't know how it ever became so popular. I think actually every generation rediscovers how ludicrous it is and has to kick it out again. It's like, yeah, some of these myths we've seen before, and it seems to be part of the job of being a free and enlightened person is you have to fight again for your freedom, and that's what we're doing again in this generation. We're going to have to fight for it again.
More people do, you know, because I really see a lot of people not really caring whatsoever.
Yeah, well, I mean, maybe they're going to have to wait till they see mass graves, you know, with their friends in those graves before they realize they've got to start fighting. You know, but they will at that point. You know, there is a trigger when people do realize they've got to start fighting. But let's hope that it doesn't have to get to that point, you know?
Well, when we say fighting as well, we mean in an intellectual term, even more so than philosophical term.
If we start fighting now, we can fight intellectually. But if it comes to the point where we actually do have mass graves, you know, with bodies being dumped into them, it will go beyond that and it will be a shooting war.
But let's hope that we don't get to that point. You can't even beat them at a shooting war because they have all the guns, they have all the weapons, they have all the money, the wealth, the power. There's no way you can ever beat the state. I mean, they're just too ridiculously powerful at anything. You know, there's no point even going there. That's why it's so important.
Yeah,
that people.
There gets to a point where when you've actually suffered the loss of a loved one, some forms of rational thinking also go out the door, because, like, look at Palestine, right? I mean, people are strapping on bomb belts, right? And people who've done that are not just some crazed, lunatic, brainwashed people. They're actually quite normal people. Mm. Now, why is that? Because it really, when it gets to a certain point, we have deep things that are programmed into us that we really, it's very hard to, you know, go against the tribal need to protect and the ability of the human being to actually be a predator is quite strong. So once you trigger that in people, once you actually trigger the people that they're actually going to take on that role of being actual aggressors, it's very hard to switch that off again. But then again, it's hard to switch it on as well, see? And like, people will put up with incredible hardships and not do anything. Then suddenly they become motivated and activated, and then they will become incredibly aggressive. And, you know, we're trying to, you know, always sort of bring the path of reason through, you know. And at the moment what we're seeing is people are too slack, too lazy, too mentally lazy. They're not actually aggressive enough, right? But it'd be quite easy to get to a situation where people are getting too aggressive. You know what I mean? They go too far, and then they're picking up guns and they're shooting people. We don't want that either. You know, it's hard to be the voice of reason.
Yeah, well, I mean, this is while we're on the topic of, you know, talking hypotheticals.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, this is the reason why I always go back to the fact, well, it's all about voluntarism, because then you vote with your dollar, you vote with your money, you vote with your shares, you vote with your friends, and you don't need to constantly be battling these huge people that just take money from you to build these huge industrial military complexes around you. And I mean, it's a whole another show and a whole concept. One other thing in this Twitter feed that you posted a few days ago,
yes,
or
sir.
I posted it, was that Robert F. Kennedy Jr. had come out is on this big campaign.
Oh yeah. Well, he's been on that
vaccine cover up.
He's been on that campaign for quite a few years. And and also the actor Jim Carrey is a strong supporter of it as well. Robert F. Kennedy Jr. is the son of Robert Kennedy, Bobby Kennedy, the assassinated brother of JFK.
Yeah.
And it's really important, his work. It's very, very, very excellent.
Go check out
material.
That video if you want to just Google it. Just type in Robert F. Kennedy Jr., shocking vaccine cover-up. It's an amazing video. He really sounds like JFK, actually. He's got that sort of husky voice. But
he looks similar too. He's got a similar look. And you know, he's engaging there with something that's quite, controversial. And, I just hope he's doesn't take too many, private plane flights. You know what I mean?
Oh yeah, he doesn't want to get the Kennedy curse.
Yeah, yeah. Just flying in a small plane is not a good idea when you're somewhere.
Yeah, he doesn't want to, have two bullet holes in the head and then people say that he committed suicide or something. You know?
Well, I was referring to the brother of the son of Kennedy. Well, a lot of political leaders have died in mysterious plane crashes.
Yeah, that's right.
So the JFK's son. John F. Kennedy Jr. Died that way. Never been properly investigated.
Another fantastic. I'm not sure if you mentioned this on the show in the start, but the whole Facebook removes boycott BP group.
Oh, look. Yeah, I really. Yeah, thanks for bringing that up. Look, folks, this is why I said don't rely on Facebook for activism. I said that in a show a while ago, remember?
But don't rely on it as your one and only.
I'm a bit concerned, honestly, because a lot of the networks that I've been connecting with are on Facebook only, and only on Facebook. And there's a whole lot of great people on there that I don't have any other connection with. So if their account goes or my account goes, I'll never be able to find those people again. And I'm getting lots of good information from them. And I'm finding it frustrating because they're all using Facebook and thinking it's great, because there's this great information network on there that I'm tapping into. Because I came to Facebook pretty late. I never used it as a social networking thing. I'm only using it as a truth networking thing. But folks, it's not a safe platform. You own nothing on there. You can be kicked off any time. They can delete
without
it.
Explanation.
Yeah, they don't have to give a reason. They just it's
no,
a
it's
private
their network.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah.
Now, this is why there's a whole group of people actually programming right now as we speak.
Yeah.
It was amazing. They actually came up with it. It was just these four university students studying, hardcore coding and all that sort of stuff at MIT. They basically said they went to a sort of micro investing site where you can pitch an idea and the world just, funds you $10 here and there. And you sort of fill up your quota. You say, well, I want $4,000 for this project, and 400 people give their $10 each. But they said, look, we want to give up our summer to program because Facebook is quite dangerous. A, you've got the privacy issues that everyone's pedoed about. And secondly, if you've got a big campaign and suddenly it's centrally controlled. Someone's got all your information. They just shut it off.
Yeah.
And so what they're doing is saying, hey, well, we can build a Facebook-style protocol, but you actually host your end of the node on your server. So and it'll be totally open source. It'll so you create a fan page or whatever, and people can connect all these different pages from around the web.
That is so fantastic.
Your information is staying on your server.
Have you got a name for that, or something people can Google, or a URL for that?
It was something I found about a month ago, and okay. And I will find it again. I'll tweet it in the Truth News Oz Twitter stream.
Excellent. Now, look, we're getting towards the end of the show. I've just got one last, what I'm going to call the stupid story of the week. And
stupid story.
Yeah, the week's stupid story, and we're going to go out with that. Inventor hopes that a coat of paint will save the world. In a remote corner of the Peruvian Andes, men in paint-daubed overalls diligently coat a mountain summit with whitewash in an experimental bid to recuperate the country's melting glaciers. In a rather bizarre sight, at 4756 metres above sea level. The man behind the idea is not a glaciologist, but an inventor who hopes to regrow a glacier with the right climatic conditions. I leave you to explore that story at your leisure.
Oh, just wait a couple of years, mate. You know, it'll come back.
But the environmental vandalism of it, he's putting paint all over a bloody mountain. I mean, it's so outrageously obnoxious.
But you know what? He got funding by the World Bank to do that.
Is that... Oh, my God.
Oh, hang on. It's not the World Bank. It's either the IMF or the World Bank. It's one of these big things who had this competition for environmentalism competition.
Look, I mean...
His idea won.
It's madness, folks. I mean, imagine coning a mountain with paint. What about the animals that might be, you know, foraging there or, you know...
No. You got to stop global warming.
Just so ludicrous, and that's you know, if you take one thing from this show, just, you know, just have a laugh.
Yeah.
All right, it's been great. It's been grand.
Please leave comments and join the Twitter group. We love hearing from our people. So tweet us and retweet us. We'll retweet you if you come up with some good stuff. Also leave comment on Truth News Radio Australia, the truthnews.com.au site.
Please do. See you next week.
Ciao.